triathlon today, you'll still be in good company if you start walking. The Centers for Disease Control says more Americans are walking regularly, 15 million more in 2010 than 2005. But the center's latest survey shows fewer than half of U.S. adults exercise enough to actually improve their health. CDC Director Thomas Frieden suggests people take up walking because it's simple and requires no special skills or equipment.
Make it part of your life. That's not just going to be one effort that's going to last a couple of days or weeks or months, but something that you're going to keep doing throughout your life. And of course, walking is something that most people will be able to do for most of their lives.
That's CDC Director Thomas Frieden. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
The guest for the first hour of the show today is Robert Sutton. He's professor of management at Stanford University, and he's someone who has become very well known for writing about what it takes to survive a nasty workplace. He's become so well known for this that he is inundated with stories about bosses who damage the performance and the self-worth of their employees. At the same time, he says something interesting. He says when people dream of the ideal boss, what it is they want is a really great boss. They want more than someone who just isn't a certified jerk. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll talk a little bit about what it takes to be a skilled and compassionate supervisor, and that is the subject of a new book that Robert Sutton has written. The title of his book is Good Boss, Bad Boss, the subtitle How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst. Business Plus is the publisher. Robert Sutton, our guest, is professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University. He's written many articles and a number of books. And in his research and writing, he's interested in what makes for good management and how an organization or an individual can actually put that into practice. He's also interested in creativity and innovation in organizations. And he's joining us this morning from Stanford. And we're really pleased that he could spend some time with us. And Professor Sutton, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
I'm delighted to be here.
And I suppose that one, at some point, one has to say that in as much as there are people who dream of being their own boss, aspiring to that, some people get the chance to do that. Probably for most people in most of their working lives, having a supervisor will be a fact of life. And it's just not something that they're going to be able to get away from.
Yeah, well, roughly about 70% of Americans have a boss of some kind. And the other thing, being in Silicon Valley and being exposed to entrepreneurs where people always dream of being their own boss, well, even when you're a CEO, you usually have this thing called a board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of your boss, and they can fire you and often do. So it's really hard to get away from it.
Almost everybody has to answer to somebody.
That's right. I mean, ask Mark Hurd out here, who just got fired by his board at Hewlett-Packard for being a bad boy. I mean, it happens to everybody.
Well, I think he had some personal indiscretions there. Well,
yes.
That overlapped into the workplace. So it wasn't simply that he yelled at his employees. But that's sort of another subject.
But the more general point is that it's pretty hard to get away from almost no matter how senior you are. And then, of course, there's the argument that A.G. Laffley from Procter & Gamble likes to say, which is the customer's boss. So it's pretty hard to get away from.
Yeah. The other thing that seems to emerge over and over again in surveys and studies, when you ask people about the stresses they feel on their job, it seems that many people, if you ask them, well, what do you think is the biggest source of stress in your job? Many, many people will say, it's my boss. And in fact, here in the book, amazingly enough, you quote a survey that was done a couple of years ago by the Zogby people. And they asked, asked people if they had experienced bullying in the workplace. And 37% said, yes, they had. And of those people, they said, well, who was the aggressor here? Who was the person who was the bully? Almost three quarters said it was their supervisor.
And it's because that person has authority over you, and also they're kind of in your face all day. So it tends to be the immediate boss. So, if, for example, if you're a nurse in a hospital, it isn't the CEO of the hospital. It's that surgeon or nurse supervisor you're working with every day. So it's that sort of close contact. One thing I'm also very quick to point out, though, since I've looked in this evidence quite closely, there's sort of this irony almost that about 75% of Americans, and there's studies decade after decade keep showing this in all sorts of samples, show that about 75% of Americans and people in other cultures too will report that their boss is their biggest source of stress. Mm-hmm. But then when you ask them, essentially, is your boss competent? Is your boss civilized? At any one time, 80% of us will report that our boss is actually pretty good. Mm. So it isn't all bad news. And at any one time, to go to the Zogby survey, between 12 and 9% of us have a boss who is a kind of a bullying jerk. Because one of the reasons you get those two numbers, 12% and 37%, is that people tend to run from crummy, mean bosses at a remarkable rate. So if you're a mean-spirited boss, you got to be careful, because in this economy, people might be being nice, they might be kissing up because they need a job, but boy, when that opening comes, people are going to be running for the exits, especially your best people.
Yeah. Well, I think those are two important points. Somebody like you, who's well known for having written on this subject, I'm sure you're a magnet for bad boss stories.
Yes.
On the other hand, that it's somewhat encouraging that, broadly speaking, probably most people, if you ask them what's their boss like, generally speaking, they're going to say, well, this person, he, she, is actually pretty good. Of course, there's stress comes with jobs, and there's stress on the boss, and that often leads the boss to put stress on the workers. So that also is a natural feature of the workplace.
Yeah, and one thing that's implied in your comment, which I think is very important, I'm thinking of, I've been fortunate to spend some time around Pixar in the last couple of years as an example that brings us all those films like The Incredibles and Ratatouille and Up. Just they're amazing stuff. And if you look at the situation that, say, that Brad Bird, the director of The Incredibles, was in, well, I mean, there are so many pressures from so many places. You got the money pressures, you got the production pressures, you got the talent pressures, you got, being a boss is a very difficult sort of job. On the other hand, the best ones, and Brad is one I would count among them, handle it with a certain sort of grace, and they make people do their best work, and they also aren't overly abusive on them. Yeah. So, for all the bosses out there, I have a lot of respect for what you're doing, and I know how hard it is. And it also is a talent that, with experience, that people can get better at. Mm.
I have a caller here I want to get to. Just one further point, and that is this particular book is, I think, designed to help people who aspire to be better bosses. And it grows out of your previous book, which is about jerks in the workplace. And I can't actually, I don't think I can say the title because it
we'll all get
has
arrested.
A bad word in it. So, but essentially, it was about jerks in the workplace. And a lot
right.
of people reacted to that. And in fact, even I think you mentioned here in the preface that one of them was your wife, who is
yes.
CEO of the Girl Scouts of Northern California, basically said, look, what I want, and I'm sure a lot of bosses would say, I actually want to be a better boss. I want to be not just competent. I want to be a great
right.
boss. So what they're saying to you is, you know, tell me what to do. How can I be not just competent, but how can I be really, really good at being a boss?
And to that point, I think that there's a couple of key things, main themes that come out in the book. But if I was going to pick one, it's this notion of self-awareness, that the best bosses understand what it feels like to work for them. And so they're in tune with the people that work for them. They listen to them. They actually know the people they work with well enough to know when to push them, to know when to back off. And that level of self-awareness and sensitivity to others is something that not all of us have. And one thing that's also very important is there's a lot of evidence that it isn't just inborn. It's something that the best bosses develop across the course of their careers. There's one executive I've taught with, former executive I've taught with for years, is his name was Webb McKinney, and he was a HP executive, and he was brought in as engineer, and he had one employee after about 3 years, and he said he worked his way up, and they gave him like five employees, and they gave him a business. Eventually, he ran the PC division and other parts of the company. And to me, that's how good management development happens. Although Webb was very, very sort of a self-aware person and in tune with the people he led, he was sort of like brought up through a system where he got more and more experience. And frankly, that's one of the problems that you take the famous Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook out here. One of the problems that somebody like that faces, and I think maybe we all need to give Mark a little slack, he's pretty young, and he keeps getting sort of better and better on the job. And then the other part about that, which is really important for every boss in every situation, is if you just think it's all about your skills, you're in trouble. The real skill and talent comes from that ability to develop and use your team. So I already mentioned Mark Zuckerberg, who now has a great team and probably our most famous and infamous CEO out here, is Steve Jobs, who by all accounts did a terrible job of dealing with his team. And got fired from Apple and next went underground in large part because of some of his personal issues. But he's actually gotten much better in his old age about being a team player and picking a team that that compensates for his weaknesses. And so I think there's sort of a lesson in that it's sort of a journey, and understanding how to use your immediate team in particular is really important.
Yeah, well, that just underscores the bottom line here is that this idea that you need to be self-aware, be in tune with your employees,
yes,
is something that doesn't just happen. That's something that you have to work at, and that good bosses do work at it.
And I think it's true. I also think that there are just some people who are more self-aware than others. To give an example, there's a guy at Facebook who is exactly the same age as Mark Zuckerberg. His name is Chris Cox. I actually saw Chris on 60 Minutes the other day, which just shocked me because last time I talked to him, he was a 23-year-old kid. Now he's a 27-year-old kid. But he's one of the most mature and empathetic people I've ever met in my life of any age. And having somebody like that on your team, you take somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, might offset some of his insensitivities and the like. And there's one of the reasons that Chris has been so successful at Facebook is I think that Mark recognizes he needs somebody like Chris.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Robert Sutton, is professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University and has done a lot of writing and research on what it is that makes for good management. What's the difference between a good boss and a bad boss? And that is, in fact, the title of a recently published book that he has authored, Good Boss, Bad Boss. It's published by Business Plus, and the subtitle is How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst. So if you have comments about bosses, good or bad, or questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a couple of people here to talk with. Leroy is the first.
Great.
Line one right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
The best bosses I've ever had, and probably the best boss I ever had, was an individual who was extremely competent and set a positive workplace environment, and he was also a very, very good teacher and never shied away from explaining to someone that was new in the firm what to do and how to do it, what this was, and so on and so forth, explain in detail and show people how to do things and so forth. And the worst employment, I guess I should have, is in places where the management allowed a really rather hostile environment to exist, and people were treated pretty badly all across the board, and it came from the top. The parties in charge were indifferent, and the people immediately under them were just sort of nasty, and the highest echelons allowed that to happen and didn't take note of it and so on and so forth. Finally, the one question I have for you is one thing I've noticed over the years in the many places I've been employed is the supervisors and or people that generally that I work with, maybe just immediately above me in rank or something like that, whatever, that I found most difficult to get along with were people of, particularly males, of less than average stature. I'm hardly a giant. I'm just barely 6 foot tall, but I frequently found myself working under or being supervised by some guy, you know, who's 5 foot six. And I always had the feeling, and the way they behaved frequently made me think that these are characters that have a chip on their shoulder, you know, a psychological problem. They got to prove how tough they are to people that are, you know, bigger than they are, physically bigger than they are, and so forth. So they're always trying to one-up you in one way or another or whatever, always trying to prove their superiority. And frequently, because of that, they were very, very ambitious and almost always worked their way up to the famous point of the Peter Principle, where they rose just to the point where they were at minimal competency, and it showed, and so on and so forth. So, if you would comment upon that, have you ever done any part of your study include a look at or an examination of the physical characteristics of a good boss versus a bad boss? Thank you.
That's a tough question. What is it? I feel like starting to sing Short People or something. But that aside, I guess I have sort of two comments. Yes, there is some evidence that if you control for everything, so actually nice experimental studies that we human beings, both men and women, by the way, tend to prefer taller leaders. And there also is some mythology around the Napoleon syndrome. But the question of whether or not being short makes people more insecure and more aggressive, I don't think is actually, there's not a clear empirical case for. But there is evidence on the sort of bullying side that the caller Leroy is talking about, that for whatever reason, so maybe you happen to have a boss who was both short and insecure, and perhaps insecure because he was short, that for whatever reason, if something leads people to feel insecure about the position they have, in fact, there's some new research that has been coming out that it will lead them to be more assertive and more aggressive. So in fact, some of the worst and most abusive bosses are young males who are inexperienced. And there's kind of two explanations there. One is they don't have the experience, so they tend to sort of push other people around a little bit too much. And the other reason might just be old-fashioned testosterone poisoning that happens with younger people. But I'm not willing to say that if you've got a short boss, you're in trouble. There's plenty of short bosses I know who are awfully good. I was actually just mentioning Mark Zuckerberg, who is not a particularly tall person. And I think there's plenty of people who have been not tall bosses who have done quite a good job. But if that's the source of their insecurity, well, then you may get some abuse.
Just maybe one other thing that just occurs to me, and it's one of the things sort of on your list of things that make a good boss, and it just sort of pops into my mind, is that it's the boss has to be someone who demonstrates their willingness to do whatever needs to be done. And not to be too trivial, it's like, you know, if the coffee pot's dirty and needs to be cleaned out, well, okay, take your turn. And somehow things like that, you can't say, well, some task that needs to be done that everybody does is beneath me. You can't do that.
That really is an interesting comment, and it's one of those things that has such incredible symbolic effect. And also, by the way, it shows that you understand how the work is done. So sort of on two extremes, there's a guy, famous senior executive, especially in Germany, named Hasso Plattner. Full disclosure, he donated money to a center that I'm part of at Stanford. But I once went to a meeting where Hasso was operating this incredibly complicated software that his firm runs. And it was absolutely amazing that, he knew exactly how it worked. And that's not exactly doing the most trivial chores, but that impressed his people very much that he actually understood the product. And then on, the other extreme, I have a friend, I teach with him a lot, named Perry Claibon, who has had quite a few executive positions, including he was a COO for years of Patagonia, which makes like the nice outdoor clothing and is a very progressive company. They actually put, they say, environmental issues and employee needs first. But there's like the story, like Perry goes back to visit Patagonia, and the person who's most excited to see him is the maintenance man, because even though Perry was the COO, every night he'd help the maintenance man carry out the trash.
Wow.
And sort of the amount of credit, and Perry was like one of those things, it was just something, just the way I was raised, I couldn't help myself. But everybody sort of remembers how Perry would sort of pitch in. And in that case, as Perry said in his sort of humble way, he said, well, it had two effects. One was that, you know, it sort of made them respect me more. And the other thing is anything they asked them to do, they could never say it was beneath me.
Yeah.
So from a leadership standpoint, I think that's right. And the implication I teach some MBAs at Stanford, and I always distinguish between the good MBAs and the bad MBAs. And the hallmark of a good MBA or a bad MBA to me is when they keep saying it's beneath me, I'll never have to do dirt work like this again in my career. And the really good MBAs, no, that's not the truth. You should get out and do it.
All right. Let's talk with somebody in the community, Belgium, nearby, line number 4. Hello. Hey. Hi.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
In the last century, I had several jobs that because of economic downturns, I was thrown out of, and so I had various bosses, good and bad. But the worst boss I have is the one I have now, and that's myself, because I'm self-employed. I push myself much harder, and purposely, I don't have any employees, because the one thing I do not want to do in life is fire a person. You don't know how seriously demeaning that is to a person's ego and stuff, even though you may not have had anything to do with it. It might have been economic conditions that caused your demise. You still blame everything on yourself. So I decide not to have any employees. But it's really tough being both the boss and the employee because you have to cover everything. And you come to realize that being a boss is not an easy job either. You know, there's a lot of pressures from every direction that have to be considered.
Well,
and I think that's pretty much the end of my comment.
Well, excellent point. I don't know, Professor Sutton, you want to comment on that?
Well, two things that the caller said struck me. The first thing that does strike me is, and this is one of those things that, especially I think when I was a young assistant professor, and I actually did my dissertation or early research on downsizing and plant closings in the Midwest. So I lived through some of the experiences that the caller is talking about. But I used to think that, first of all, being a boss was pretty easy. And second, that bosses who do layoffs are all sort of insensitive, cruel jerks. And the first thing I learned once I started getting some management responsibility and studying it is the caller says, it's really not that easy to do because, and especially I sort of imagine the caller being sort of like the guy who runs the hotel in the classic restaurant where he's got like all these different hats to wear. And that's difficult because it requires a range of skill in coordinating yourself. So that's difficult, but it's difficult for any boss. And then the other part that I guess I would add for you and I guess for other employers is that, or potential employers, I guess in your case, is that, you know, kind of for the economy to come back, maybe we need to take some risk. And yes, firing people really is something that sucks, but there are ways to do it that does less damage to people. And also, as I think the caller implied, having a job where there's some risk you're going to lose it is much less stressful than having no job at all. So although I empathize with how difficult it is to let people go and the risk, that it might be a risk worth taking for all of us, because we need it in the economy, not just for this particular caller.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Robert Sutton. He's professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University, has written many articles and a number of books about things like what makes for good management and how do organizations or individuals, for that matter, put that into practice. He's also interested in creativity and innovation in organizations. And he is the author of a recently published book that is titled Good Boss, Bad Boss, How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst. And it is intended to be a book that helps, or it's intended to help people who are bosses and want to be good bosses, and not just competent, but really good. It's published by Business Plus. It is out in the bookstore now if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, questions here are welcome. If you want to tell us a boss story, good or bad, or you have other kinds of thoughts about what makes for a good supervisor, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. There are just so many things here that we could talk about. Maybe just to pick one, and this is difficult.
Sure.
Because in a sense, I guess it connects back with the idea that, you know, being a boss might mean that sometime you would have to tell somebody that they didn't have a job anymore. But that is that somehow you've got to show people that you're behind them. And that is a matter of not just talking like you're behind them.
Right.
But when it really comes down to it, really being behind them, you know, having their back. That's the way you talk about it in the book, and that's the way that it's really got to be. And I'm sure that that's something that's much easier to posture that is easy. But to do it, now that's harder.
Well, to that point, and as you're implying, one of the chapters in the book is about being a human shield. And if you look at surveys across the workplace and say, what are the characteristics of a good boss? It's somebody who has my back, who, to the extent that is not insane, and sometimes it is insane, will protect my needs, will protect me from intrusions, incompetence, idiocy of all kinds. And when you look at great bosses, they have two characteristics. One is they know how far they can push it without getting fired or getting the team in trouble or too much trouble. And also there becomes a point where they're kind of willing to lay down for the team when something really extreme happens. So in the range of things that bosses do to protect their employees, sometimes it's just really trivial. There's this great expression from Henry Mintzberg, well-known organizational theorist, that a boss or a manager's job is to see visitors so employees can get their work done. Although I think that might be tough for our self-employed guy who's got no employees. So that's sort of simple things. Sometimes it's doing things like when there's procedures that come on from high from the organization, either blowing them off, getting people to ignore them. A friend of mine, Bonnie Simi, she's an executive and pilot at JetBlue. She was leading a pretty big group, and they had these sort of long and, she thought, in some ways overly idiotic performance evaluation form that had hundreds of questions. She just cut it to 20 questions, and she said it was just fine. Mm. And that saved everybody a lot of time. And then finally, in extreme cases, and this is something actually is going to appear on the Harvard Business Review blog in a few days, there's sometimes when bosses will lay down to protect themselves. In the story that I was talking about, that really is an example of bosses who will serve as a human shield. So I already mentioned Pixar, which is one of my favorite organizations on earth, not just because they make great stuff, but it's such a caring, prideful place in the best possible sense. So the two founders of Pixar are Ed Catmull, who still runs it essentially. He's now really a Disney executive, and a famous crazy guy from Silicon Valley named Alvy Ray Smith, who, among other things, invented the technology that made things possible. And there was one point in Pixar's history, which is an amazing history, where they were part of LucasArts, which is owned by George Lucas. And George Lucas had two problems. One, he lost faith in the animated movies they were making. And then the other thing that happened was he was getting an expensive divorce and he needed money. So he brought in an efficiency expert and told him they had to sort of cut down what is now Pixar. And at one point, this efficiency expert kept saying every day to Alvy Ray Smith and to Ed Catmull, you've got to give us a list of the people you're going to lay off. you've got to give us a list of the people you're going to lay off. And they kept resisting. And finally, one day, they were told they had to have the list in by 9 the next morning. So they gave them a list. And the list had two names on it, Alvy Ray Smith and Ed Catmull. And I told the story at Pixar. I have since had Ed Catmull confirm it. And the reason that story is so powerful, and Ed, by the way, just thought it was a stupid business decision because they were prettying it up to be sold. And in fact, Steve Jobs bought it for $5 million. But it's interesting that I've been back to Pixar probably about once every 6 months in the last few years. Somebody almost always tells me that story because it sort of creates this psychological safety that they've got our backs. Now, I'm not recommending if you're a boss that you sort of lay down for your employees. It may be irrational for lots of reasons, but that feeling of psychological safety that comes from a boss who's really willing to go to bat for you is really impressive. And as I say, it's part of sort of the spirit and lore of Pixar that has made them feel safe to take chances and feel like their bosses aren't out to get them and are on their side. Yeah.
I have a couple of other callers we'll get to, but here's an email that's come in and I want to have you respond to because I think
sure.
It also makes some really good points. And here's what the person writes. The person writes, "My boss is too nice to a fault. I do good work because I feel like I should, but there are weeks where I seriously don't do much. I've asked for guidance and things to do, but I think my boss is so concerned about not wanting to make anyone upset, he never tells us what to do. He just assumes that our department will do what we need to do." The person goes on and writes, "I think it's a trend from other stories I hear where bosses are afraid to hold people accountable at the risk of upsetting people. Yes, there has to be respect. But where can a boss try to draw the line at working nicely with others, but make sure they're getting the most out of their staff?"
Well, I love that question. And in fact, one of the things that if I was to even rewrite Good Boss, Bad Boss, I might emphasize more is this curious case of the really nice boss who isn't particularly competent at the job. And by the way, there is even some evidence that CEOs who aren't particularly competent but are really nice, that their boards of directors have a harder time firing them. So it's like we all, and you know, you feel so bad. But if you actually look at the characteristics of the best boss, and we've got some great new studies by some researchers, Ames and Frank Flynn at Stanford have done this stuff. And what it shows is when people rate their bosses, and this is very consistent with what the writers' problem have is the people they respect the most push hard enough that they make clear that they're in charge. They push hard enough so they make clear they're in the teaching role. One of the earlier callers mentioned that the best boss he ever had was just about always in a teaching role. You think of sort of like a great coach. But they also know when to back off and get out of the way. And so sort of walking this plank or I don't know, plank's probably the wrong word, sort of a tightrope between being too pushy and not pushy enough or too nice versus too tough is really one of the hallmarks of being a good boss. And I also think in the caller's case or the writer's case, it gets back to this notion of being in tune with the people that you work with. They probably all perceive this guy this way. And again, I think that this is a skill that, in this case, an overly nice and not directive enough boss can learn through experience. And the interesting thing is, I always wonder with a boss like this who clearly means well, whether he understands how he's coming across and seen. Because again, that's one of the ironies is when somebody is likable, it's harder to give them negative feedback. But it sounds like this guy needs some.
All right.
A little coaching.
Of some of my other callers here, we have someone in on a cell phone here. St. Anne, Illinois is the caller, and line 4 is the line right here. Hello.
Yeah, David, great program. Enjoying it a lot.
Thanks.
Just a couple of quick points. I'll tell you where I'm coming from and give you some information to chew on. I am a supervisor in a property management firm, several locations, personnel. And I actually got into the job. I have an MBA and I have another master's degree, of which I'm not really using, but I'm guessing it gave me the credentials to get the position. And I can remember my first day having all the keys and opening the door and turning the lights on and going, okay, now what the hell am I doing here? So I really had to depend on my employees because it was kind of a counter position where they actually were training me. And I supervised them, but they taught me the ropes, if you will. And what worked for me is thanking them, little things, thank you notes, little gift certificates, something like this. I can remember I gave one personnel a box of candy because they performed very well. And she's like, well, what is this for? And I'm like, well, this is for you. And so these people basically came from an environment, you know, like with a dog being hit with a rolled up newspaper. And if you're nice to them, they're like looking at you cockeyed going, okay, what's the real objective here? But I can tell you just from a position to supervise, as a supervision type of thing, one of the most frustrating is having people in a position where they're not really trained and they don't really know what their job is or what their expectations are. That's extremely frustrating, and it's not really their fault, but I find that over and over again. And then the other thing, the other pitfall to avoid is employees not getting along with each other, but getting along with their boss. And you get the story from two different sides, and sometimes you feel like King Solomon where you split the baby in half, and you really can't afford to take sides because then you're done for. But anyway, those are some observations. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, you can.
Well, I thought that was just fabulous. There's so much wisdom in that. It's ridiculous. One is the notion of actually listening to people when you take a job when they know more than you. That's something that a lot of people with authority have plenty of problems with. So I applaud the caller for that. The other thing I would really hone in on that he talked about is, in part of it, is this issue that when you're in a position of authority over others, and I'm not talking about being the grand CEO, just having a little bit more authority, being the supervisor, that the things that you do are incredibly magnified. So in this case, those little gifts, those little thank yous, they can be so powerful. It's absolutely incredible. And by the way, I mean, this isn't just in addition to the caller's wonderful practices. This isn't just, sort of like talking off the top. We keep getting more and more empirical studies that the power of small acts of gratitude are something that have huge effects that people don't realize the degree to which they did it. So I really admire that caller in his self-awareness in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. So that was quite, I thought, inspiring and something that I think all of us can sort of learn from.
Yeah. It's something else that it also just, though, raises in my mind that is this. That we know from studying groups of animals that are very hierarchical that the animals in the group, they're in constantly watching the leader. Every couple seconds they're looking at the leader because, you know, the leader, the mood of the leader, what the leader does, this is really very important. The alpha animal is constantly being watched by everybody else. Well, with groups of people, it works the same way. And so maybe supervisors don't know it, but the people that work for them are constantly watching them very, very closely. And I'm sure probably if you have a bad boss, someone who maybe has fits of temper, maybe you watch that person even more closely because you're looking
right.
for the red flag. You're looking, okay,
well,
what's going
to
set this
slapped.
Yeah, you say, so what's going to set this person off? You know, are we getting to the brink here? Do I need to back off? Do I need to leave? You know, whatever it is. And I'm not sure supervisors appreciate the fact that they're constantly being scrutinized by their workers for little signs of what's going on.
Yeah, and in fact, we've got some actually great experimental evidence from a bunch of researchers. Dr. Keltner at UC Berkeley is one of them. That what ends up happening is that when you put people in positions of power, they actually become even more oblivious to the fact that other people are watching them. So that's sort of a warning for all bosses, independently of personality, is that by being given power over people, sometimes you become even more oblivious to what it feels like to work for you. But yeah, that's one of the characteristics of being in a position of authority. And that's one of the things I like so much about the last caller. This is a guy who clearly got that people were watching him very closely. And by the way, to that point, they especially watch you closely your first couple of weeks on the job. That's when the spotlight shines especially bright.
Yeah. All right. Here's another caller in Decatur. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a comment regarding a systemic problem that I see in the workforce. We're increasingly becoming global, and we've got corporations now in the United States that are based or headquartered in Europe and elsewhere. My life partner worked for a company, and I'll name it, it's Kerry Foods, Irish-based. She quit the company because of her boss. And there was two problems with the company. Number one, the Irish tend to be a little bit, good old boy society, and women don't have much of a use in the corporation. And it's pretty chauvinistic, male-dominated. And that was compounded by the fact that she worked for a Tunisian. This guy is Islamic, and unfortunately, they have a very condescending attitude towards women, a very demeaning, cut you off, condescending. So she just gave up and quit. And like I say, this is a problem that I see as we globalize, and it's a systemic problem, and I don't think these people care, and certainly her boss didn't even, he obviously didn't care about trying to improve his mannerisms or anything else. So I'll listen to your comments.
All right.
Oh, well, that's an easy one. But to be a little bit more serious, the first thing I would say that other cultures do not have a corner on sexism. I see plenty of sexism from, you know, American-born folks in all sorts of ways. So there's not a corner on that, and smart women know that it's good to look for a workplace where women are actually supported rather than pushed down. I was actually, speaking of Apple, I've said nice things about Apple. I noticed I looked at the list of the top 11 people in the company, and they're all men. So it's like this seems to happen many other places. But you know, the first thing besides, and every professional woman I know could tell you that that you've got to do all you can to avoid working for bosses in situations like that, if you can possibly avoid it. But the first thing that I start with in those situations is two things have to happen when you've got people who are from traditional backgrounds where, if you will, women are not given sufficient respect, and otherwise it doesn't really work. The first thing is there has to be some incentive when they're bad. And it's amazing the power. A friend of mine who at one point ran a large law firm said she made amazing progress with some sexist partners when they took a large hunk of pay from their bonus one year for being sexist pigs. And she said, you should have seen how quickly they came around. And then the other thing which is related to this is because of the cultural differences, again, they may not even be aware that they're doing this. And so finding some way to have feedback and coaching and responsibility will change their behavior. But to the caller's point, as somebody who's worked with companies all around the world, yes, there are some companies that are so incredibly sexist that it does make it very difficult. But there are international firms that have traditionally acted that way that are starting to make remarkable progress, including having been to Dubai several times. Dubai is an interesting culture because although it's a traditional Arab and Muslim culture, they've always been incredibly supportive of women, and you see women in many more positions of authority there than you do in any other Arab country, at least that I know of. And so they have sort of in that country sort of turned things around a bit, including in some of the major corporations. But to the caller's point, it's a reality. There's an awful lot of sexism around there. In some places, it's worse than others. So my heart goes out to your wife, and it's no fun to work in a situation like that.
We have about 10 minutes left, and
great.
Actually a little bit less than that. Our guest is Robert Sutton. He is professor of management science and engineering at Stanford and is author of the book Good Boss, Bad Boss, How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst, published by Business Plus. Here's another email that perhaps was in response to the earlier one. Mm-hmm. Here the person writes, I'm a new boss. I have a problem employee. This person triangulates every situation, pitting coworkers against each other, misses deadlines, avoids direct communication by ignoring emails and missing meetings, treats others, including me, with disrespect. I'm afraid I'm turning into a bad boss, but I don't know what to do with this. Any advice would be appreciated. And the person goes on to say, yes, I will buy your book. So you've sold the book.
Well,
you've sold the book.
My kind
now,
of person.
Now what can you tell this person?
Well, to that point, there's a chapter in the book, and this is something that I think every good boss knows, on doing the dirty work. And the fact is, and there is a great, actually, fairly large body of research that now shows that bosses who, if you will, do the dirty work, which means that they're relatively quick to give negative feedback to people who deserve it, to give them warnings when necessary, and to this boss, make sure you document everything this guy does. It makes it much easier for everybody to get rid of them. And also, finally, when it's necessary, move them out as quickly as possible. Because and what this gets to is there's some really quite interesting research on rotten apples, bad apple employees, and they are so infectious. Just having one person like this just packs a wallop. So essentially, a bad employee, in terms of the wallop, packs five times the wallop of a good employee. So if you will, the first thing to do is eliminate the negative. So if this guy's a new boss, my perspective is that it's your job to really give this person a lot of negative feedback, and if necessary, move them out as quickly as possible. And the interesting thing that the research on rotten apples and on and also on badly performing employees shows that when supervisors act more quickly against employees like this, that everybody else who works for them are happier and more productive, because they all know that the person is poisonous. So this is, I guess, that balancing act again, that being too nice and not decisive enough can get you in trouble. And as I say, this is the chapter on doing the dirty work, and you could probably find it and read it about my blog for free, since I want to do more than just sell some books. I've written about this quite a bit, also at the Harvard Business Review blog. You can find it there as well. But tough thing to do. And the other thing I always advise is, if you're a great boss but you can't find somebody, you don't have it in your heart to do the dirty work, pair up with somebody who will be a bad cop and do it for you. That's another strategy that's worked for a lot of bosses, is they've sort of found the henchmen.
Okay, let's go to, we have a couple of callers here that would try to get at least one, if not both. Line two is next. This is Champagne. Hello.
I appreciate this segment. This is a really neat topic. My question was, you know, with all these issues with bosses, good, bad, and the different skill sets, personality types, even physical features perhaps, what is training, you know, the training of bosses, I guess business schools, I don't know, where, you know, wherever bosses come from, what's being done to sort of address this, to try and improve their work? I come from the mental health field, and you know, we have our range of people. We have bosses, but we also work interpersonally with people. And I was thinking, you know, are there different fields or areas that business or, you know, whoever trains people who typically go into management are drawing from to improve the skills of bosses in this way, or what things are being implemented into the training programs, just changing whatever's conventionally been done at business schools and such to train bosses to improve this issue. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
That is a great question. And even though I'm a management school professor and I believe somewhat in management education, if you actually look at the evidence, it's quite interesting, which is that how good a school you go to or how good your grades are as an MBA actually does not predict your success on the job at all. It might help you get a better job if you go to a fancier school, but the issue is that it's one thing to learn how to talk about an occupation, and that's really what management education is generally about, maybe a little experiential stuff. But the evidence we have is, to the extent that you actually learn how to do stuff on the job, that's where the action is. Maybe a little coaching, maybe with a little bit of education. And when I look at some of the great U.S. corporations that have developed people, General Electric, Procter & Gamble, well, General Motors a long time ago when it was a well-managed company, maybe this will be true again. What they do is they sort of take people from the beginning and they sort of bring them along kind of one step at a time. Oh, you know, since you guys are in the Midwest, the company I always admire on this dimension, maybe not in others, is McDonald's. Mm-hmm. I've done a little work with McDonald's. When you talk with people at McDonald's, they almost always have significant experience in the stores And they sort of work their way up the chain. So managing work that you understand and giving people the opportunity to develop as managers over time is really the most powerful thing. And as I say, McDonald's is actually quite good at it.
All right, we'll try to do one more real quick here. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if you could say something about where there are no bosses, where there are teams. And there seems to be in research especially an attempt to not have a boss. Is it important to have to designate one person as a boss? I see it happening when you have chairs that are revolving chairs. It's
right. I think there has to, the management responsibilities have to be done by the group in some way or another. Chairs is sort of a classic sort of thing, and I think the way that that really gets done best is when you have at least a point person whose job it is to coordinate it, and that might be a rotating role. But I think the caller has a good question, because management is a function, it's not a person, although sometimes it's best done by one person or at least coordinated by them.
Well, we're at the point we have about a minute, and I apologize, maybe we can't, we have one more person we can't take here, so we're going to have to wrap up. There's
great.
People should explore your writing, because there's a whole lot more that you speak to these questions and others. They can take a look at Good Boss, Bad Boss, they can go elsewhere. Is there, though, any last kind of very little gem you can drop here for people before we go?
Well, to me, for bosses, there's two diagnostic questions you might want to think about yourself. Number one, do you actually understand what it feels like to work for you? And number two, if the people who worked for you now had the choice to do it all over again, what would they do? And really knowing the answers to that question, I think, are sort of many of the keys to everything.
Yeah, and it's just I guess I find myself going back to the idea that it's not easy. Being a worker is not easy. Being a boss is not easy.
And it's not
there's
easy.
This as you say here, this fundamental problem, this big balancing act between how do you push people enough to get the job done and expect them to do good work, and yet then treat them like decent human beings.
And it's a craft that the best bosses develop over time. So for bosses who are new, be patient and keep trying. You'll get better at it.
Yeah. Our guest with this hour, Robert Sutton, is professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University. He is the author of the book Good Boss, Bad Boss, How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst. It's published by Business Plus. And Professor Sutton, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And also we want to say thanks to Ryan Roberts, who's the technical director on the other end of our connection there with Stanford University.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Time on my hands. On the next Fresh Air, an in-studio concert and conversation with singer Susie Arioli and guitarist Jordan Officer. Their new album is called All the Way. Join us. In view.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we head toward the last few hours of trading for this particular marketing session. And as we look at the screen, we see that soybeans have recovered from their overnight electronic losses as traders continue to wonder about the size of the U.S. soybean crop due to the worst U.S. drought in decades. Analysts say they believe USDA on Friday's crop production report will trim soybean production to 2.79 billion bushels from the last USDA production estimate of 3.05 billion. That's about a 8.7% decline. Analysts expect a soybean yield forecast of 37.2 bushels to the acre, and that's down 8.1% from the previous forecast of 40.5 bushels to the acre. Hasn't slowed demand, though. Today, USDA, through private exporters, announced sale of 140,000 metric tons of soybeans to unidentified customers during the 12 and 13 marketing year. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in Kansas City. September wheat at 887 and three quarters, down 8 1/4. December 9.11, down 8 3/4. In Chicago, September wheat 884 and a quarter, down 4 3/4. December 898 and three quarters, down 97 and three quarters, and now a half, down 5 1/4. September corn,